and iTunes International. Virus free.
Around the world and down your street.
This is Bondi Tunes International broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. I'm joined by Mike Brand, who is our correspondent in Hod HaSharon in Israel, near to Tel Aviv, and Europe correspondent Declan Hughes in Dublin in Ireland. Welcome both of you to this broadcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks very much, Henry.
Mike Brand, first of all, you're in the thick of things there near Tel Aviv in Israel. There's been a lot of international news going on with, you know, the problems that, you've been having with the Gaza Strip. And we want to talk about Benjamin Netanyahu. And I will ask Declan to talk about, because Declan has done a history degree at UCD in Dublin, as far as I understand. Declan, correct me if I'm wrong. But first of all, Mike Brand, what is the feeling in Israel? And is it possible that Benjamin Netanyahu, as the prime minister of that country, could go down after 12 years in office?
Well, as I'm talking personally now. I certainly hope so. We have, suffered from this man for the last 12 years. Now, I'm not saying that he hasn't done anything good for Israel. He has done a lot of good things for Israel. But he has, let's say, outdone his stay, and he should have gone a long time ago. He's all now mixed up in a court case, or in many court cases, for bribery, etc., etc. And he has been doing everything he can for the last week or so to stay in power. Now, the change government, as they are called here in Israel, have managed to form a government, but even so, Netanyahu and his cronies are trying to pressure people who might try to the weaker link of the change government, and they're pressuring them to defect from the government, even though the Yair Lapid, who is the head of the change government at the moment, went to the president and said, "I have a government." Now, most people would say, the other side would say, "Okay, he's done it. Good luck to them." But not Netanyahu. He is pressuring people in the right wing of the change government to defect.
It is quite amazing. I mean, unlike the United States of America, where you only get two terms, here in Australia, we had John Howard, who was a prime minister in the 90s up to the early zeros. He had three terms of 4 years in office. Obviously, in Israel, you can go as long as you like. It's like not a secret that he has been really corrupt in his time. Why did he keep the support of, let's say, the support of his supporters, I suppose? How did he keep that when everyone knew? I mean, it was really the skeleton in, you know, the closet sort of thing that everyone knew. The worst kept secret, if you like, that he was corrupt. Why did he continue? I'm just wondering if it was a democratic process that kept Benjamin Netanyahu in power.
Oh, absolutely, yes. People voted for the Likud. And the person who is or was leading the Likud at the time and today is Benjamin Netanyahu. So, yes, it's absolutely democratic. Yes.
And but he could get kicked out. And the process of that is very, very complicated in the Knesset, you know, the parliament in Israel. Do you think, you know, you said to me off air through, you know, various mediums, that it's really not a done deal.
Look, it's supposed to be a done deal, but Netanyahu will not give up until it is too late, when the government has been sworn in, which hopefully it will be another week or so. But that a week in politics, at least here in Israel, is a very, very long time.
Yes.
And he will keep the pressure on all the right wingers who are who could defect. Even so, even if they defect, he will not get a government. He does not have the 61 people or seats that is needed to form a government. What he will do, or what that will do, is that the change government will not have the 61 seats. That's the only thing. He cannot form a government if these people defect. But then what will happen is that it will go back to the Knesset for 21 days, and then, hopefully it won't, but that's the next phase. And then if in 21 days nobody can form a government, either from the Likud or from Yesh Atid, the biggest party in the opposition, if nobody can form a government in those 21 days, then guess what? We're going to our fifth elections.
In 2 years.
Yes.
That's unbelievable. Yes. I thought we had swings and roundabouts with prime ministers in Australia, but that's ridiculous. Declan Hughes, and I know, you know, I know that Mike Brand, I know you know the history of Israel. Of course you do. You moved to Israel before I lived there in 1983. So, but Declan, I know that you've got a good history of many countries around the world over the last 10 years. We've talked a lot about this. I'm interested in your view on the history of Israel and Palestine.
Well, the Palestine-Israel situation is a classic example of the withdrawal of the British Empire, as we know ourselves on the island of Ireland only too well. And the similar idea of having the two-state solution was put in place there, except they never fully implemented the two-state solution. And you found the borders of the 1948 Israeli state excluded what we now know as the West Bank. They were given to Jordan. And so it was a much smaller state than it currently is in practice. And there was a number of people who were left inside the borders of Jordan who thought there was going to be a Palestinian Arab state, which has yet to materialize in reality, even though there is a functioning, after a fashion, Palestinian Arab state in parts of the West Bank, and they have a piece of the Gaza Strip, which has changed hands two or three times over the centuries. Egypt invaded it, I think, shortly before the 1967 war, and so on. So there's been a lot of moving boundaries, shall we say, since the foundation of Israel in 1948. But what the main thing that happened was when Gamal Abdel Nasser took over Egypt in the 1950s. He got this idea to have a United Arab Republic with Syria. So when the United Arab Republic was functioning from about 1958 to 1961, Israel was surrounded by two big enemies and then a lot of other smaller enemies. I think Mike would concur with me on that one. And the United Arab Republic was basically an Egyptian-dominated situation because they had a larger population, and the way Nasser run it, he was squeezing the Syrians out of positions of authority even in Syria. And eventually the Syrians got fed up with this and pulled out in 1961. So the United Arab Republic then in name was effectively Egypt, and it remained under that name till 1971, which is significant because the 1967 famous 7-day war took place while there was still this notional United Arab Republic. And again, it was this idea of having a pan-Arab federation of states lined up against Israel that was behind the whole situation where the Arabs decided to attack in 1967. And Israel, I think, because it was on its own from a military point of view, and the fact that there was like one chain of command and you didn't have to consult with like four or five other armies, they were able to react much quicker. And that was probably the key to their success. But their tactics were absolutely brilliant during the war. They attacked all the Air Force bases that were within immediate danger of damaging Israel. And they took them out of it straight away, which meant that the combined Arab forces were reduced to losing their land forces. And again, they subsequently attacked those as well using their Air Force. And it was a superb military success, definitely, led by Moshe Dayan, I think, was the general in charge of that scenario. And I believe Golda Meir was prime minister at the time. Would I be right, Mike?
Wow. Now, I know Golda Meir was the prime minister in the 1973 war, I'm not sure who was prime minister in the 1967 war. What?
Well, as far as I know, Golda Meir succeeded Ben-Gurion, and I don't know if Ben-Gurion was still around by 67, because Ben-Gurion was an old man when he took over in 1947. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yes.
But it was a very brilliant military campaign, and they effectively emasculated the armies around them. But as you said yourself, 1973, Syria in particular wanted to try and regain some of the lost territory. Israel had taken the Golan Heights, if memory serves me, in 1967, and had also taken over the entire Sinai Peninsula. So Egypt wanted its land back, as it saw it, and Syria wanted its land back, as it saw it. And that motivated the 1973 attack. But the 1973 attack was, like, they weren't fighting as many countries in 1973 as they had been fighting in, I think it was just Egypt and Syria, effectively, in 1973. And again, I'm doing this purely from memory.
Yeah. No, Israel told Jordan to stay out, and they did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Self-confidence. what you see. The winner takes it all.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Mike Brand in Hot Ashran in Israel, near Tel Aviv, and Europe correspondent Declan Hughes is in Dublin, in Ireland. Interesting, when I lived in Israel in 1983, Jordan was a friend of Israel. And you know, Israel being surrounded by so many Arab states, and I'm not so sure if it was one of these friends who are not really friends, but I could I got a bus into Jordan to get into North Africa, actually, to Egypt. And I could get through Jordan. That was the only way I could get there. Was Jordan a fair weather friend, if you like, of Israel, and where does it stand now? Because it is in a kind of a sticky mess here, isn't it?
What we like to say here is a cold peace. We are at peace with Jordan and with Egypt as well, but it's not really a hot piece. That, you know, there are still a lot of people in Jordan and in Egypt that are against the peace accords of the times that Sadat made and King Hussein made at the time. There are still a lot of people against Israel. So we call it here a cold peace. But I just want to say one thing, Declan. It's very interesting that you said, and a lot of people also say it, that when you start the history of Israel, you start in 1948 or 47. Israel was around in, ancient times. There was Judea, and the Israelis and the Jews. Yeah. The Jews have been in Israel, or in this area, I would say, for over 2,000 years.
I was kind of tracing the roots of the present conflict, but yeah,
right,
that's fair.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree with you 100%, it's very interesting that the people, the government that let the people settle in the West Bank in the first place was the Labour Party, right? Not the Likud, not the right wing, but the left or centre-left people. They were the people that left the settlers in the first place, which, if you look at it, it's quite amazing.
But also, in fairness to Israel, the population density is quite huge. You're looking at a piece of land, Henry, that's smaller than Ireland and has double the population.
Yes, that's a very good point, isn't it?
And with the 1948 borders, you'd have a serious overcrowding problem at this stage, Mike. Would I be right?
Yes, but there weren't that many people then. There weren't that many people. But you see, the thing is that there are a lot of countries in the area that are very clever. Like Declan said, the Gaza Strip was under Egyptian rule. Now, when Israel overran the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and whatever, in the peace accords where Sadat with Israel, Sadat said, I don't want the Gaza Strip back. I don't want it. He was a very clever man. And Israel was stuck, if you can call it that, with the Gaza Strip until Sharon, Prime Minister Sharon, pulled out. So, President Sadat was a very, very, very clever guy. He said, I don't want this. It's just a load of trouble. And it is.
Well, one of the interesting things that happened in Syria was when the Ba'ath Party regained power in a coup in the 1960s, Assad's father, Hafez Assad, reached the presidency in 1971. So by the time the 1973 war came around, the Assads and the Ba'ath Party were in full control over events within Syria. And that still is having repercussions to what's happening in that neck of the woods at this time, because they've become something of a family dynasty. I think there was a period of about 18 months where when Assad Sr. stepped down, somebody else was interim prime minister or interim president, while Assad Jr., who's in power now, was learning the ropes, so to speak. But pretty soon after that, he took over, and the rest we know. But it's just interesting that we're 50 years after Assad Sr. came to power in Syria.
Yeah, I just want to say, if you're mentioning Syria, I mean, we had now a couple of weeks ago a 10-day war operation, whatever you want to call it, where rockets were fired, 4,000 rockets were fired at civilian areas on purpose by the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. Now, in that war or operation, whatever you want to call it, six Israelis were died and 230, I think, Palestinians or Gazans also died. Now, that every life that is lost on either side is a tragedy. But what I want to say, because Declan mentioned Syria, over the last couple of years, 250,000 civilians have died in Syria. And nobody, I haven't heard any government really condemn Assad. I haven't. Yeah. But when 200 people are killed in Gaza because the Hamas put them in the front line, that's something else. Everybody's up against Israel. You're murderers, genocide, etc., etc. 230. Yeah. And we're talking about 250,000.
I was going to say, but Mike, it's almost a forgotten conflict at this stage.
Yeah. Nobody over the last couple of years has raised an eyebrow to Syria. But Israel, when they have 230 casualties on the other side, everybody's against them. Well, we are murderers, genocide, you name it, they said it.
Mike Brand and Declan Hughes. Declan's in Dublin. Mike Brand is in Hot Hasharon near Tel Aviv in Israel for us. You know, what you've just been talking to me stinks of a word called media. Now, we are media. But, you know, I'm looking at an Al Jazeera. Okay, I'm looking at an Al Jazeera website, and that's going to make you laugh, Mike Brand. Okay. And interesting, we all, you know, just to explain, Al Jazeera broadcasts out of Doha in the Middle East, and is puts up headlines like "Laughable, Naive Palestinians Party or Palestinian Party's Move to Join Israel Government. Palestinian Activists Say Decision by the Leader of the United Arab List Party Displays a Fundamental Misunderstanding of Israeli Politics." Break that down for me. I don't really understand this.
Well, first of all, it's not the... First of all, let's get things a little bit straight here. There are two Arab parties in the Knesset at the moment. They are the Ra'am party, which is the Islamic, an Islamic party. But more is quite, I would say, I wouldn't say it is a radical party. It's, and then there's the United Arab Party, the United Arab List, which is a mixture of three or four parties together. But when we're talking about the party that is going, that has already joined the change government, it's the Ra'am party, who is the head is a guy called Mansour Abbas, and everybody was running after him because he's got five seats, I think, in the Knesset at the moment, and everybody wanted his five seats so they could go over the 61 seat threshold to form the next government. So, you know, Netanyahu is saying at the moment, he's for terrorism, he's for this, he's for that. But he was running after him himself, and he didn't get him. So it's not the United Arab list we're talking about at the moment.
Yes.
We're talking about the Islamic list called Ra'am.
And we're talking about the media as well. Declan, you know, it's interesting here in Australia that this is international news. Benjamin Netanyahu possibly going out of power. It seems to me to be such a grey area because it is kind of complicated. Australians don't seem to care. You know, I know we're far away geographically, but we just don't seem to care. It makes like a tidbit of news here in Europe. And, you know, if you watch the media like RTE, the national broadcaster in Ireland, or the BBC in the UK, do you think they're giving this a serious coverage? And do you think, Declan, that it's, I hate to use this term, fair and balanced?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It is mentioned regularly, and it's mentioned on a very, I would say, sketchy basis. Like the nuances of Israeli politics, Mike has explained to me in the conversation we've been having in the last few minutes, details about how they are attempting to create a new coalition to overthrow Netanyahu, and again details that haven't really emerged in as clear and concise detail as Mike has just outlined. I mean, the situation is, just to give Mike an example, is if this was an Irish Parliament situation, whoever was trying to form the government would be offering the leader of that Arab party a ministry in return for support in the parliament. That's how that would be being done. Yeah, we're going to give you we're going to give you one ministry or one deputy ministry. You'd be either the minister or the minister of state, as we call it here. So they'd give them even a seat at the cabinet table, or at least listening right to the cabinet table in return for their support. And that's how that job would be done here. So it's because we've been used to having multi-party coalitions here in recent years. I think the last time we had a single-party government majority, Henry O'Donovan was living in Ireland. That's how long ago that was. And in fact, it was even 10 years, if I recall correctly, roughly before Henry O'Donovan considered leaving Ireland. So it's quite some time ago indeed. But so we used to and we've also had minority parties supported by a handful of independents and so on. And again, I think in one of those minority governments we had, they offered there was a group of independents that were voting as a bloc. They offered one of their members a seat of the cabinet to keep them sweet and make sure they got the support and got over the line for the big crucial votes. But that's normal politics and against a backdrop of a relatively peaceful scenario in this country at the moment. Again, I was wondering, was part of Benjamin Netanyahu's crackdown on Gaza a little bit of distraction from his personal difficulties with regards to all the corruption allegations against him? You know, a form of deflection, the same kind of thing that the Tories did in the 80s when they fought the Falklands War when they were losing in the opinion polls.
Absolutely.
Yes, and what did it do, Declan? What did it do, Declan? It just made Thatcher more popular.
It did. It got a re-election. And again, maybe Netanyahu was hoping, if I crack down on the rockets coming in from Gaza, I'll be seen as the hard man again, and I'll get a bit more support on coming back to my cause, and the people forget about the corruption because I'm cracking down on all these people firing rockets into my country. You know?
Mm. Yes, I agree 100% here with Declan, and it was said here not once and not twice in the newspapers and the TV that he would produce something in Israel that first of all would take away from his trial, which he's on trial at this moment, and that he would try through this crackdown on Gaza to get the right-wing parties. There are two right-wing parties now in the change government, and he would get those right-wing parties to support him and not the left-wing parties. Like there are two left-wing parties. One of them is Labour, which is like centre-left, and another one called Meretz, which is left. And he's been doing this for weeks now, don't join the left wingers. The left wingers really, are traitors.
I've seen this, and he really is doing some fear mongering here, isn't he? Against
absolutely,
yeah. Against the left.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one thing that Declan now said that is, you know, it's seen here now that it's an interesting word that he said was they're trying to overthrow Ken. That was in Hebrew. They're trying to overthrow Netanyahu. Now, who do you overthrow? You overthrow a dictator. You overthrow, people like that. And I want to tell you something that before Netanyahu became prime minister, and one of his actual things that he was like, he said it on a TV show, and it is recorded, and I have it on my Facebook page as well a couple of months back, but he said, when or if I become prime minister, I will say that a prime minister can only run for two runs of office, two credentials.
Yes, and we talked about that earlier on, where, you know, in some countries like America, you can only run for two terms.
Right, and here you can't. Here you can run. Now the change government, one of the first laws they want to bring in is that you can only run for prime minister for two terms. And also that any person that is under or on trial may not be prime minister. And this is like, it's like, think about it. You know, we have a prime minister that is going to court three times a week, but he's still prime minister. How is that? How could that happen?
I know, but stranger things have happened. Declan.
I was going to say, he could go potentially straight from prime minister to prison.
Declan in Dublin, I don't even know. I've been away from Ireland for 30 years, and I have lost all contact with I've got no excuse. I've got this thing called the internet. But can you go over two terms in Ireland?
Oh, yeah. You can, yeah.
So
very rarely, it very rarely happens. I mean, we had, historically, we had William Cosgrave was prime minister for 10 years at the start of the founding of the state. He was followed by De Valera, who was prime minister from 1932 to 1948. And then again from 54 to 57, I think.
Oh, my God.
but we haven't had that kind of thing since, really. Lamass was prime minister for 3 or 4 years. Lynch was in from 65 to 73, and then again from 77 to 79. And then Haughey had periods in and out of office, Fitzgerald had periods in and out of office. Bruton was in for 3 or 4 years. Reynolds was in for 3 or 4 years. Bertie Ahern was in for about 10 years. He was probably the next one.
Thank you. Bondi Tunes International. Around the world and down your street.
Well, look, you know, I know I keep talking about the media here because it's so important. And I want to talk about social media. I know you guys are stuck for time, but just bear with me. Now, I know the IBA in Israel, the Israeli Broadcasting Authority, is the national broadcaster. You know, I want to ask you, Mike Brand, in Israel, how do you feel their politics is? It must be very difficult. Are they, you know, the ABC here in Australia, the BBC in the UK, RTE in Ireland are always, I mean, if you're the public broadcaster, you're always going to be criticised by a lot of people. You can never do the right thing. Do you think the IBA in Israel are balanced?
Look, to tell you the truth, we have now here three main channels. Channel 11, which is the IBA, and Channel 12 and Channel 13, which are independent TV stations, commercial stations.
Yes.
And today, not many people watch Channel 11. No, they don't watch the IBA news. They watch Channel 12 and they watch Channel 13.
Is that a problem?
No. Why should it be a problem?
See, the reason I'm asking this question is because are the IBA... Fair. I hate to keep using this term because it keeps making me think of Fox News. But are they fair and balanced? Are they doing what a national broadcaster should do? So why are people watching them?
Because it's boring, and the other people are more sensational. You know, they come out with more sensational words. But you know what? We for the first time, I would say since 1995. We have journalists that are being threatened. Their children are being threatened by the right wing, by the radical right wing. The journalists are getting threatened. They're getting death threats. Their children are getting threats. Their wives are getting threats, or husbands, as it may be.
But where are these journalists? Broadcasting what
from
networks?
From Channel 12 and Channel 13.
So the commercial networks,
The commercial networks, yes. Mm. And they had in Channel 13, for instance, there were several journalists that were told not to speak against Netanyahu, and if they did, they would be fired. And in the end, these journalists resigned. This happened about a year ago, I would say. Yes, there was an Arab Israeli journalist, very, very popular, very likable. Lucy Awish is her name. And she went to a rally. It was online. It wasn't even a rally, a real rally. And she spoke for fair broadcasting. Mm. The next day she was fired. Now she started her own television station on the internet called Democrat TV.
Yeah,
and it's very popular. It's run by the people themselves with contributions by the people, and that is the stage we've got to here in Israel today. Mm. That you cannot trust any of them. You can't trust any of the TV stations or the radio stations. We have we have an army radio station. And they are now being run by pro-Netanyahu people.
Yeah, and so, that's no good. It is understandable that terrestrial television, terrestrial radio is on its way out, as far as I'm concerned, as a broadcaster. You both are broadcasters, and you will understand when I say that I really think that commercial television, if we look at the younger generations who are, and you know, Declan, you're the same age as me, and Mike, you're only about a year or two older than me. I mean, we are the baby boomers. And the people above us, as in the older people, are going to die off. And with that, I think terrestrial television and radio is going to die off with them. Because if you look at a 25-year-old, and I know, you know, Mike, you've got children who are adults now, and I think living in the UK. These people, I'm talking about actually younger than them. I'm talking about kids in their early 20s, late teens. They're not going to watch this stuff anymore. And the reason I'm sort of linking all this in with this is because social media is having a huge effect on what goes on in world wars. Declan, you know, in Ireland, do you think social media affects what goes on in government there?
Oh, absolutely. And, well, you're seeing situations where, I'll give you an example from the non-political sphere. England cricket team had a guy that made their debut for the cricket team the other day. And somebody dug up some old silly tweets he had posted in his teens, which were racist and deemed to be offensive. And he found himself having to apologise in his mid-20s for something stupid he did when he was 17 or 18. That happened so long ago. But stuff that goes on social media doesn't go away. And that's something that people who Twitter a lot and who tweet a lot and who put posts up on various different platforms tend to forget. That if you put something up in text or something, even if you put a piece of audio up...
It doesn't go away because it gets shared.
It's shared, and people will be able to find it 15, 20 years later, long after you've forgotten. And in fairness to the individual concerned, maybe long after he's changed his opinion on certain matters.
Mm. Politicians have this problem all the time. You know, with politicians. With politicians, it's not something that happened on social media 20 years ago. It's something because they were public people in the media. They said something, you know, 25 years ago, and they are suddenly ostracized now. But, you know, Mike Brand in Israel, does social media play heavily into the news? I mean, that is probably a rhetorical question amongst young Israelis.
Young Israelis,
do they not care?
I mean, if we're talking young Israelis, what do you talk about? Your kid or under 20?
Let's talk about that age. Under 20, they
really, you know, it's either they're deeply involved in politics or they couldn't care less.
One extreme or the other, right?
They really couldn't care less.
Okay, we're just having communication problems with you. Can you just run that by us again? Young people don't care or care a lot, right?
Yes, yeah. You either go one extreme or the other. Mm. You either get involved in a political party or you don't. But the ones who don't, they couldn't care less what's going on in the news. They don't even know what's going on in the news.
Let me ask you, Mike, when you were, let's say, 20, did you care what was going on in the news?
Well, when I was 20, I was working for the BBC World Service.
And so was I.
I was working for the BBC News department.
That's kind of different because I was on Nova at the BBC later in 87. But the thing is, I only cared about news because I was a newsreader and I had to care about the news. But otherwise, my friends couldn't give a damn, you know?
Yeah. I used to go to work reading the Times newspaper in England, you know. So that when I was, and I was 20, and then I'm 20, I came here to Israel. But the people here in Israel, they're either apathetic or they're really into it. But as I'm saying, the social media here is that all these demonstrations where tens of thousands of people came to Balfour every Saturday was done through Facebook and Instagram and everything like that. And not, you know, you couldn't publish it in a newspaper unless it's a left-wing newspaper, obviously. Yeah. And there was no other way. But still, tens of thousands of people came. So Facebook, at least for the old people like me, is still... you know, that's where you learn your news and what's going on and where things are going to happen, etc. And Instagram, maybe for the younger people.
Yes.
But yeah, so social media here, it's like, you know, this, the last couple of general elections, there used to be on radio and TV half an hour of party political broadcasts before each election. That stopped. It stopped a long time ago because all the political parties moved their campaigns over to Facebook.
Declan in Dublin, how do you note it would affect social media would affect what goes on in politics, or would you concur that most people, let's say 18 to 25, probably don't care?
Well. It depends. I mean, there are, like, when I was 20 years of age, I was studying politics and history in university. I was in a political party, and I was encouraged to join one of the big political parties to see how they work from the inside by one of my politics lecturers. And as it happens, I was in one that was different to the one he was in, you know? Mm. So, but nevertheless, he said, that's a very good idea. See how it works from the inside. See how it is on the ground. And it was during that period where we had three elections in under 2 years.
Yes, you might remember that. Yes, I do.
Yeah. And so I was on the ground canvassing with a candidate on two or three occasions, and I saw how it worked on the ground, and it was very illuminating and very helpful for my studies. And so I was interested in the news, but I was watching news programs on TV when I was 5 and 6 years of age, because, like,
we were living
in Canada at the time.
Oh, you were in Canada, yes.
Yeah, and the Vietnam War was on. So you'd have daily highlights of the Vietnam War on your news bulletins every day, kind of thing, you know?
Declan, I have a question. In Ireland, even today, do you vote for a person or do you vote for a party?
In Britain,
you'd vote for a person.
Yeah, in our electoral system, it's proportional representation, single transferable vote, which I believe to be the best electoral system in the world, because you're given a list of 22 candidates. Now, we've multiple seat constituencies, so you might be living in a 4-seat constituency or a 3-seat constituency. So that means you can go number one in the case of Israel, number one, that guy from the Arab party. Number two, if he gets eliminated, his vote gets transferred to a guy from another party. Number three could be the guy from the Israeli Labour Party. So even if you're voting for minority parties, if your candidates get eliminated, your vote is transferred to your second choice candidate or your third choice candidate. So you might get maybe not exactly what you want, but you get your least awful choice. Mm. And if you don't... Mm. Get your vote, just don't put it down on the ballot paper. You don't put the number in.
Mike Brand, very interesting question that you just asked Declan, because here in Australia, as I mentioned earlier on in our broadcast tonight, you know, we had swings and roundabouts with prime ministers, not quite as bad as Israel with elections, but we had our swings and roundabouts. We had like 3 prime ministers in 5 years, and we kept on having elections. But it is interesting because I think that, you know, I think that we're going into a stage where really it's very volatile. Politics are volatile. And I just wonder, and I want to, we've got to finish this soon because I've kept you on far too long. I just wanted to ask you how you feel about the future of Israel, because that's where we started in all this this conversation. Do you, people you know, or I know your kids probably live overseas, but you know, what's the feeling in Israel about the potential downfall of Netanyahu? Is there a sense of hope for those who hate him?
People dislike him. I wouldn't say that people hate him, but I don't like him, as they say, for the and his wife also, which is also a very, very big Christian here in Israel. Mm. I'm not going to go into it now because we could do a whole program just on her.
Not Imelda Marcos and her shoes.
I think she's probably worse.
Oh, dear.
She's probably worse. I mean, these are the Netanyahu's. One of the stories going around, I'm just going to be very quick, that they used to take their dirty laundry to the White House because it's done free there. So they used to take suitcases full of dirty laundry to the White House. But that was Sarah. Never mind. I won't go into that
You're
at the moment.
Kidding.
But But I won't go into it. We could just spend one program just on her.
Yes.
Well, what I'm saying is that people are, you know, not the right wingers, but or the I would say the I'm not going to say that, but the good right wingers. I don't know if there's a good and a bad.
Oh, I'm sure
but,
there are.
most people are. They want this government of change. And they are sick of Netanyahu and all his tricks. Mm. And we are in for a lot of tricks over the next week until this next government is sworn in. And we are, you know, we are going to be prepared for a lot of things. The right wingers in the change government are going to be pressured like they've never been pressured before. They're going to be demonstrations. There are at the moment demonstrations outside their houses. As I say, their children are threatened, they are threatened, and we just want to see the back of this man. Let him go back to his Caesarea, his Caesarea home, which we just paid 1 million shekels for his city taxes.
And that's just the taxis, right?
Just the taxis. That's just one thing. You know, he just got himself and his family bulletproof cars with all the latest gadgets.
I bet they need them.
And he's building it.
And I bet they need them.
And he built himself like an Air Force One. You know?
Oh,
and there are so many poor people here in Israel. And he built himself an Air Force One, which cost billions of shekels.
Gosh.
And people want this guy to go and to retire and whatever. Just get him out. That's most of the people. That's what most of the people here in Israel want.
Okay. Declan Hughes, last comments on what you think the future of Israel is.
Well, I'm hopeful that this attempt to replace Netanyahu will succeed on this occasion. But we'll be watching with interest because it's sometimes in political situations, and you look at situations like we were talking about Syria earlier. Syria is one of those situations where the Assad regime is evil, but the alternative is probably even worse, ISIS. You know, that's it.
Yes.
So it's kind of like...
Are you saying the lesser of two evils, right?
Well, yeah. Well, it's evil, eviler, and evilest kind of thing is these the options in Syria. Just to get back to an earlier question, I realized I hadn't answered it, whether people vote for the party or vote for the person.
Yes,
I think it depends from constituency to constituency. Like in my old constituency where I was living at the last election, there's a candidate representing a very large political party. That's a 32-county party, if you know whom I mean, Henry.
Yes, indeed.
And they're... Candidates are normally assessed on how much constituency work they do and how well they look after their constituents. Now, this candidate is the worst member of the parliament, the laziest member of the parliament. And at the last election, she got elected with two quotas. Why? Because she's in this particular organization.
Yes. And I actually didn't answer a question that I wanted to answer, which was here in Australia, we don't vote for who's the most popular leader, we actually vote for the party because on a number of occasions through our history, recent history in Australia, we've had the leader of the opposition with much lower points in the votes than the actual prime minister. But still, it's the party that matters. It doesn't really matter who, you know, what the polls say about the leader. And that's been proven again and again. Now, we have to go. It's so good of you both to take so much time. I know we could talk about this for hours, but thank you so much. I know, Mike Brand, you in Israel, I know you've just come off air, and I know, Declan Hughes in Dublin, you have now got to do some research for a sports broadcast, but you both spent so much time, 47 minutes and 3 seconds. Can you tell I'm a broadcaster or what? thank you both for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
Well, you're very welcome, Henry.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
From Australia, this is Bondi Tunes.
This has got to be the saddest day of my life. I called you here today for a bit of bad news. I won't be able to see you anymore because of my obligations and the ties that you have. We've been meeting here every day. And since this is our last day together, I want to hold you just one more time. When you turn and walk away, don't look back. I want to remember you just like this. Let's just kiss and say goodbye.
To meet you here today, there's just so many things to say. Please don't stop me till I'm through. This is something I hate to do. You, I can't lie.
I'm gonna miss you.
I've got ties, and so do you. I just think this is the thing to do. It's gonna hurt me.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.